Well, good morning again.
Good morning.
Our sermon series is called Do Not Conform, Lessons from 1 Peter, and this morning's sermon is Live Good Lives Among Unbelievers. And that's a good, helpful message. We need that. We need to be good so that our actions can lead people to glorify God. But before we get into the text, let's deal a little bit with the context. See, 1 Peter was written to a specific community in a specific cultural context. And if we are going to read and interpret and apply this text faithfully, we have to get this. The letter was written to Christians living in a culture that was hostile or potentially hostile to Christianity. They were experiencing some kind of difficulty, and we're not real sure exactly what it was. There are some different ideas about that. But we know that they were dealing with some kind of difficulty, some kind of persecution, and there were different kinds at different times, sometimes endorsed by the government, sometimes unknown by the government, sometimes just kind of overlooked or even encouraged by the government. So it wasn't official, but the government was still kind of behind it. Sometimes it happened on a wide scale. Sometimes it was on an interpersonal level. But what we know is that the people were dealing with some kind of hardship because of their faith, or at least they had a realistic reason to think that bad things could happen to them because of their faith. In addition to this hostility of their environment, whatever that was, we know that 1 Peter was written to a culture that was very patriarchal. And a patriarchal culture is simply one in which men have power over women. In a patriarchal culture, men are in charge. In the Greco-Roman culture of 1 Peter's intended readers, there were a lot of well-known teachings about how households could function. And these are called household codes, and they contain some cultural norms for how things should be done in households. Now, one of those cultural norms is that the husband slash father was the head of the household. And all the other people in the home, his wife, the children, the slaves, were to obey him. He was in charge. Another cultural norm of that time period was that all the people in the home were to participate in his religion, the religion of the head of the household. And a third cultural norm is that no one in the home was to associate with friends whom the head of the household didn't know. And we see this one and the last one together in some advice from somebody named Plutarch, who wrote around this time period. And Plutarch said, and this is in a household code, so this is telling us one of these cultural norms here. Actually, it reveals two of them to us. A wife ought not to make friends of her own, but to enjoy her husband's friends in common with him. The gods are the first and most important friends. Wherefore, it is becoming for a wife to worship and to know only the gods that her husband believes in, and to shut the door tight upon all strange rituals and outlandish superstitions. And a fourth cultural norm is that the woman's place was in the home. In this cultural context, men grew up learning that as heads of households, they needed to keep a tight rein on their families. If a man's family members got out of hand, that reflected negatively on him, and his reputation. His friends and his business associates would look down on him and ridicule him, and maybe even prevent him from succeeding in business and politics, and life would be really hard for him. And in this cultural context, if the man's wife associated freely in society, people might think she was being promiscuous. That's the way people thought. And keeping the lineage pure was crucial to their economic stability. No man in that cultural context wanted his hard-earned money and property to go to sons who weren't his own. First Peter is written to Christians in a hostile and patriarchal culture. And we need to keep that in mind as we try to understand this morning's text. Felicia and Matt read chapter 2, verse 11 through chapter 3, verse 12. Let's hear part of it again. Slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them don't believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Okay, before we get into what the text is saying, let's deal with a couple of things the text is not saying. First, the text is not saying, it's not saying that slavery is okay. Of course, it also does not say that slavery is wrong, but it tells the slaves to live righteously in difficult circumstances. And the text is not saying that the oppression of women is okay. It's not saying that men should rule over women. That's part of the fall, not part of God's plan. But it tells wives to live righteously in difficult circumstances. So the text isn't saying those things. But what does it say? Well, it says at least four things. First, it says that in a culture where slavery is practiced, slaves should live righteously. Second, it says that in a culture that demeans women, wives should live righteously. And in both of these cases, righteous living included not causing more tension than their conversion to Christianity had already brought. All right, remember, the head of the household has to keep the family in line, and the wife isn't supposed to have friends that her husband doesn't know. And so imagine if you're a non-Christian head of household in that context, and your slaves and your wife are going off to worship some god that you don't know about with people you don't know, and you don't know what goes on at this meetings. Maybe you've heard some strange things. And then if you add to all of that, that whenever your wife gets ready to go, she dresses in the way that, professionally promiscuous women of the time dressed, then that would cause more alarm, right? And First Peter is saying, don't do that. Act respectfully and don't bring unnecessary conflict to the conflict that's already there just because you're Christians, right? There's already tension there. Don't add to it. Third, this text says that in a culture of extreme patriarchy, husbands should live righteously. They should be considerate of their wives. And I thought that Felicia and Matt did a great job of the reading. I love the way the emphasis was made on that one verse to the husbands. We'll get to that in a little bit. Fourth, it says that all Christians should live righteously in difficult and hostile situations. And that's in the part of the text I didn't read just now. The text is saying those things. And I want us to consider not just what the text says, but I want us to think about what the text does. What does the text do? It speaks directly to slaves and wives. And to appreciate this, we need to remember that there were other documents similar to this one, sets of cultural expectations or cultural norms for how things should happen in the home. And as I mentioned earlier, these documents are called household codes. And the household code in 1 Peter is very similar to other household codes of the time, but it's also different than the non-Christian household codes. See, the non-Christian household codes were more extreme. They presented the head of the household as the one with all power and with the responsibility to keep his wife and children and slaves in line. And those non-Christian household codes usually spoke to men, because men were heads of households, and because men were the ones who were exposed to these documents through education, household codes almost never addressed women or slaves, because women and slaves were seen as less than fully human. But the household code in 1 Peter speaks to slaves and wives. It elevates their statuses as humans. In fact, it says more to slaves and wives than it says to husbands, which should send a very clear and strong message to the husbands, the heads of households. The household code in 1 Peter also speaks to husbands, these heads of households. It tells them to be considerate of their wives and to see them as heirs of the gracious gift of life. This indicates that women and men are equally human. Okay, that might not be as shocking to you today, but imagine then. And they're equally valuable in spiritual terms. So the heads of the households need to think about more than just themselves. The people in their households are not tools for economic and political advancement. So what does the text do? It challenges cultural injustice. It challenges it covertly by addressing people whom the culture didn't deem worthy of address in household codes. And it challenges it overtly by telling husbands to be considerate of their wives who are their equals in God's eyes. Now, 1 Peter might not seem very countercultural to us today, but if we remember the letter's context, we can understand that it was perceived as countercultural at the time. The good news of Jesus is chipping away at walls of injustice and oppression. The good news of Jesus is elevating and empowering people who have been low and powerless. 1 Peter speaks to a specific community and a specific cultural context of hostility and patriarchy. The text does a few things to counter the cultural norms. It speaks directly to slaves and wives as humans. It refers to wives as heirs of the gracious gifts of life. It tells husbands to exercise their roles as heads of households in ways that are more humane and more Christ-like than the ways their culture has taught them. And when I consider the fact that 1 Peter carefully calls for some change in an oppressive culture, I find that the gospel challenges the church in every culture to become more righteous and more just than it has been in the past. Too often, when it comes to issues of social justice, the church lags behind the culture. And the culture leads the way. Maybe it's because we think our focus needs to be on evangelism instead of social justice, but 1 Peter says that living righteously can lead other people to glorify God. Righteous living is a form of evangelism. And 1 Peter demonstrates that First Peter demonstrates a kind of righteous living. It treats slaves and wives as real people. It calls husbands and the rest of the church to be more just and righteous than the surrounding culture. When we look at what 1 Peter does, we find that righteous living can be very countercultural. Righteous living involves living in ways that are different from the injustices of our culture. Instead of lagging behind the culture in issues of social justice, the church should lead the way. Well, how can we do what 1 Peter does? What injustices do we see? What forms of oppression does the gospel call us to confront in our lives? First Peter doesn't say everything I'm about to say. But if we want to do sort of like what First Peter did in countering cultural norms, then we need to think about specific needs in our own time and place. We could probably think of several, but let's deal with two this morning, and both of them stretch back a long, long way, even to the time of 1 Peter. First, the cultural context of 1 Peter valued men over women. Women were expected to be wives and mothers and to stay home in the home and to stay in the home and to submit to their husbands no matter what. And some of the ways that Christians have interpreted this and other biblical texts have contributed to the oppression of women. Back in the 1800s, a few women were active in public ministry roles. They were going against cultural norms of what women should and should not do. And the leaders of the religious establishment marginalized them. But those brave Christian women paved the way for women who came along later and pushed for social change beyond the church walls, women who worked for decades for the right to vote, women who still work for equality today. And we still struggle with female-male inequality. And sexist actions and comments continue. Sexism is an injustice in our culture. It's a form of oppression. And we need to be more just and more righteous than our cultural norms. We need to lead the way. Second, the cultural context of 1 Peter included slavery. And Christians have used that and other biblical texts to oppress enslaved people. As you know, some Christians in what is now the USA captured Africans and brought them here against their wills and forced them to work in brutal situations for no pay. We don't like to talk about that very often, but it's still part of who we are. It started in 1619 and continued until the end of the Civil War in 1865, Christians used part of the Bible, like 1 Peter, to justify treating people like animals. And of course, the Civil War was far from the end of the problem. Racial injustice continued after the Civil War. Laws were passed to limit the African Americans' newfound freedom. And we still experience the consequences of slavery today. How can I not talk about this in Memphis? To a large degree, black people and white people still don't get along. To a large degree, black people still suffer economic difficulties connected to the almost 250 years of slavery. Generations of still uncompensated labor. And the problem is more than economics. Who's more likely to get pulled over by the police? Come on, we can be real. Who's more likely to be accused of shoplifting? Who's more likely to be called racist names because they acted emotionally at a football game? Come on. That is what we call white supremacy and white privilege. We don't like to talk about that much either, do we? It makes us uncomfortable. It should. It's an injustice in our culture. It's a form of oppression. And we need to be more just and more righteous than our cultural norms. The church needs to lead the way. In these cultural contexts of injustice and oppression, how can we be more just and righteous? Well, let me suggest some responses in five areas. Well, let's respond in the area of government. If you vote, consider issues of social justice as you make your decisions. And let's respond in the area of church. Recognize that God is not white. Acknowledge that the ways we do church have been shaped by white men. Let's be intentional and creative in finding ways to empower everyone to have a place and a voice in the body of Christ. And let's respond in the area of work. Pay attention to the experiences of people who aren't like you. Welcome their stories and their perspectives. And let them influence how you do your job. For example, right now I'm rethinking how I teach. I need to be conscious of the historical context that puts barriers between some students and me. I need to be mindful of students' experiences of oppression and find ways to give those students at least some of the power that's been given to me. I'm still working on that, figuring out how to do that best. And let's respond in the area of school. Get to know classmates or fellow homeschoolers who are different from you. Their appearance might be different from yours. Their speech might be different from yours. Their ways of thinking might be different from yours. Their tastes in music might be different from yours. Their ways of dressing might be different from yours. Appreciate the cultural differences and speak up whenever people abuse your friends with physical or verbal violence, especially when it's somehow connected to race or sex. And let's respond in the area of family. Teach your children about racial and sexual discrimination. When we ignore the problem, we end up contributing to it. When parents are silent about injustice, they affirm it. And by all means, never use racist or sexist language around your children. Well, don't ever use that language, period. But also think about the impact your words can have on your children. And when they say things that hurt or demean people because of their skin color or culture or class or sex or gender, teach them to speak in the spirit of the God who spoke all the diversity of creation into existence. And children, help your parents with this too. Live such good lives among unbelievers that they may see your good deeds and glorify God. This kind of life isn't about passively enduring oppression. It's not about using whatever power we have to continue cultural systems of injustice. It's about finding ways in our daily lives to work for change that can help people and lead them to glorify God. This kind of life is something worth inviting people to, isn't it? Are you living that kind of life? Do you want that kind of life? Pay attention to the injustices around you. Admit the ways in which you have contributed to oppression. Act in countercultural ways that are just and righteous. And bathe it all in prayer. Some of our shepherds and I are going to be at the back of the room as we sing this next song, and we are available to pray with you. So if you would like prayer as you try to live this kind of life of justice and righteousness, please let us know.